We're checking in on Foxconn here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers' top aide is warning Foxconn Technology Group that it won't collect any state incentives for its scaled-down factory in Mount Pleasant if it doesn't renegotiate the deal. And meanwhile, we've heard a Foxconn executive saying that they're hamstrung trying to recruit top talent for their factory. So have you considered working for Foxconn? What opportunities do you see? How should the state handle incentives going forward? We're at 800-642-1234. Corrine Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee, and she's been covering developments between the state and Foxconn. Corey, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with understanding Foxconn's recruitment challenges. Apparently, there was a letter written to the Secretary of our state's Department of Administration. What did Foxconn executive Alan Young have to report?
According to Young, the company has traveled to several states and visited college campuses across Wisconsin to recruit workers, and they've really not had any luck.
And when did they elaborate on that? What have their recruitment strategies been?
Well, Alan Young says that, you know, they've just been trying to get people to work in these jobs that Foxconn will have. And these are artificial intelligence jobs, engineering type jobs. And that's according to Mr. Young. And he says that because unemployment is so low, he can't find anybody.
Is it realistic for large companies like Foxconn to attract workers from other states? How big of an ask is it to try to relocate workers from other states?
You know, that is a common strategy for large companies, although this week I spoke with a national recruiter who said that with the unemployment rate being so low, people are less likely to move. He also said that companies recognize that employees these days have a lot of options, so companies are doing their best to keep their people.
And so these jobs, as you mentioned, some are in artificial intelligence, some are more sophisticated engineering jobs. They're not the traditional manufacturing type jobs on a factory floor?
Well, I mean, that's what Foxconn has said, although one of the issues right now with some state legislators and the Evers administration is nobody knows for sure what kind of jobs Foxconn is going to be offering. And like I said, that's been kind of a sticking point. And so even in talking to people that have gone to recruitment fairs, they walk away with not knowing exactly what the jobs will be.
Foxconn has also been dropping in on Wisconsin colleges and setting up these hubs at some colleges. Might that recruitment effort take a longer-term investment to pay off? What's happening at these hubs?
Perhaps. These hubs, Foxconn calls them innovation centers. They're not up and running yet. They're behind. And so, you know, it could happen down the line. But again, I've gotten several reports from people who've gone to hiring fairs and they walk away kind of confused about what they're hearing. So it could just be taking longer to see a return on investment, but there's a lot of confusion right now.
We're talking about Foxconn with Corrine Hess. She's WPR's Milwaukee reporter. You can call in with your questions. What do you want to know about how the tech manufacturing giant is going about hiring, is going about getting its factory in Mount Pleasant up and running? We're at 800-642-1234. Corey, let's look at another strand of the Foxconn story. Foxconn in the state struck, you know, that unprecedented deal on economic incentives and tax credits. But now we're hearing that that deal might be in jeopardy. What's happening there?
Well, there were a series of letters over the last year. I would say it started in about March, where the Evers administration has been asking Foxconn executives to amend their 2017 contract with the state to better reflect what Foxconn is planning in southeastern Wisconsin. And the Foxconn executives have not really made a move to make these amendments. So without doing so, the Evers administration is saying that Foxconn won't be eligible for these state tax credits.
So is the deal completely off? Do we know exactly what Foxconn is getting in credits at this moment?
Well, so far, Foxconn has not received any credits. They fell short of meeting their 2018 employment goals. They hired about 180 full-time workers instead of the targeted 260. And as a result, they did not get $9.5 million in tax credits. This year, they're eligible for nearly $20 million in tax credits, but that would mean that they would have had to hire more than 500 people in 2019. So they have until April 2020 to file this report with the state. But again, they have to amend their contract to even be eligible for this. So that's what's going on right now. There's been a lot of back and forth between Foxconn and the Evers administration about this. And it's unclear if Foxconn is willing to amend their contracts.
Let's bring in Alice now in Sheboygan. Hi, Alice. What's on your mind about Foxconn? Hi.
My idea a little bit earlier than I anticipated that when they began to buy or to make footprints in different university towns in Wisconsin and the pig farm up in northern Wisconsin, they were after more of our resources and intellectual property. And that this Foxconn thing has gone so slow for blue-collar workers or white-collar workers that I think that we have been conned a bit.
Alice, thanks for the call. Corey, has this factory been on a timeline that's been slower than expected?
It has been slower than expected. And as Alice just pointed out, the properties that have been bought across the state have been much slower than anticipated. So these innovation centers a lot of them were supposed to be up and running by the end of 2018 or early 19, and they have not started. I mean, Foxconn did buy the properties, but those are definitely not up and running.
What have we heard from Wisconsin lawmakers on Foxconn's recruiting challenges?
You know, the most vocal lawmaker has been Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz, and he's a Democrat, and he has called, you know, multiple times for more transparency. And he has said that, you know, just Foxconn is not telling anybody what they're doing, what's going on. And he's basically been, like I said, the most vocal lawmaker and just called on the company to tell taxpayers exactly what they're doing.
And the state's Legislative Audit Bureau released some guidance yesterday on Foxconn. What are they recommending?
Well, what they're recommending is the WEDC, which is the state's economic development group, and they are the group that would be awarding the tax credits. They have found for a second year that the tax credits could be awarded to Foxconn for employees that don't work in the state. And so they came out and said, you know, this is not right. All employees that Foxconn hires have to be working in Wisconsin. So that came out. And they also suggested that an independent CPA, you know, certified public accountant, be hired and Foxconn pay for it, and that all the numbers submitted by Foxconn be reviewed before anything's approved.
Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Corrine Hess is WPR's Milwaukee reporter. Coming up, food delivering robots have landed at Wisconsin's largest state university. How do you feel about a robot delivering your breakfast or lunch? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hello, bots. Madison is now the largest college campus in the country to offer autonomous delivery robots. And they're bringing students food. They're navigating sidewalks, about knee-high, white square base with black wheels. Have you tried this delivery service? Have you seen the bots? Join in 800-642-1234. Peter Testori is Director of Dining and Culinary Services at UW-Madison. He manages the 30 autonomous delivery service spots created by a San Francisco firm. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So I've come across these robots at this particular intersection while I'm on a bike, and I was surprised to see they're quite small and they get lots of stares. They turn a lot of heads. Can you kind of describe their appearance of and how they operate on the sidewalks?
Yeah, so they're specifically designed to take up the average amount of space that a human takes on the sidewalk with an average stride. So that was kind of the intention behind the design for their size. We make sure that they hug the proper side of the sidewalk to ensure that pedestrians can go both ways on the sidewalks. And they're programmed to monitor everything that's happening around them up to 600 feet so that they know, you know, what's coming, when to stop, when to move, things like that.
And they can carry up to 3 bags of groceries?
Yeah, it's really about the size of the containers that will fit in there. 3 bags of groceries is what the company says on average, yes.
So inside the robot is this ability to put these, fresh items or something that is being dispatched from food services?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the inside of the bots are insulated, very, very heavy insulation. They have a divider inside so that we're able to separate hot and cold items if someone were to do an order that have both temperature requirements. Or we're able to remove the divider, to allow more space for all cold insulation or all warm insulation.
So these delivery robots are available for students and faculty and staff on campus. How does the service actually work?
So a student would download the Starship app onto their smartphone. They'd go through and put in their information to create an account. They would then, a delivery area map would pop up, and they would drop a pin, very similar to an Uber or Lyft, something like that, of where they want their order delivered to. The app will automatically move that delivery location to the nearest safest location. So, for example, if someone drops a pin in the middle of the street, it's going to automatically move it to the nearest sidewalk. And then they will confirm that drop-off location. They will choose which market of ours they'd like to have food delivered from, select their food items, process their delivery, their order, and then they're able to track the bot throughout the entire process. They'll see a little robot on the map as it's on its way to them. When the robot arrives, they'll get a notification that your delivery has arrived. They'll receive a 4-digit PIN that they enter into their phone. The top of the robot will pop up. They collect their order. They close the lid, and the robot will tell them thank you and have a nice day.
And so this delivery takes costs about $1.99?
Yes.
How has it been received on campus, Peter? How many deliveries a day? What are you seeing in the trends?
So we saw a very popular start. One of the issues that we've kind of come across since launch is we haven't been able to get the Wiz card system online, which is the campus card. So we're expecting that after the winter break, we'll be able to do kind of a relaunch with the Wiz card. The ability to pay with the Wiz card. And at that point, we're expecting orders to increase at that point. Up until now, it's been only credit or debit card. So while it started out very popular, we've kind of maintained a steady about 30 deliveries a day. But we are expecting once the Wiz card online, which is where all of the students have their funds for food, that number will increase significantly.
We're talking with Peter Testori, who is Director of Dining and Culinary Services at UW-Madison, and he manages 30 autonomous delivery service bots that are delivering food around campus. Peter, are you delivering through these bots to just a select area of the campus, or is it the entire campus?
It is pretty much the entire campus. The entire campus that we need to be able to primarily service the residence halls, because that's our primary mission, is the students that live on campus. While the Lakeshore area is pretty much all encompassed within our delivery area, we did have to go to the city, request approvals for some specific streets that are on what we call the southeast side of campus, because those streets are city-owned and maintained. So we have select streets on that area of campus, but it's primarily the streets that we need to be able to get to the specific residence halls.
So with these robots gliding across sidewalks, this also has the potential to have an interaction with a pedestrian, and also people with disabilities. How do you work through that?
So as far as your everyday average pedestrian, they do encounter them. We see the encounters all the time. We talked to a couple of colleagues in the industry that had launched this program before us, and because we were concerned, you know, what will students do with these robots traveling the streets? And they said that what they saw on their campus was that the students very quickly adapted them as part of their campus community, almost as pets, if you will. That when one got stuck, they push it out, stop and take selfies with it. They pet them as they go by. And we've seen kind of that exact same thing here on campus so far.
Well, you know, they are kind of cute.
They're adorable, aren't they?
They are. So do these robots need maintenance, or do they need to take breaks?
So Starship does have a small handful of employees that they employ. They're Starship employees, and they are responsible for putting them to bed at night, waking them up in the morning, sending them out to work, changing tires when need be, charging batteries, that type of simple maintenance. So they do require some upkeep on a daily basis, if you will, wipe out the insides, things like that. That's all maintained by Starship employees.
I wonder how these robots feel about, like, snowstorms and when it gets icy.
Yeah, so the robots themselves were born in Estonia, which is a almost identical climate to Wisconsin, maybe even a little colder, a little darker, and a little snowier. So they are used to this type of climate. We haven't, the couple snowstorms we have had so far, that's where we saw, you know, a couple would get stuck here and there. That's going to happen, and passerbys would push them out. But that'll be something that we'll have to evaluate as we go through the winter months. And obviously the robots, if the sidewalks are not safe for pedestrians, if our campus partners have not had time to clear the sidewalks, the robot, the delivery program would not be active.
Are you looking to add more robots in the future, or are you just kind of watching and seeing what happens?
I don't think so. There's no plans at this time. We expect to do between 200 to 300 orders a day once the campus card is online. And that's 30 bots would be able to maintain those orders. So there would be a point where we would have too many. So I think 30 is pretty much where we're going to stay parked at.
Does that alleviate anything in your culinary services area as to how you're getting food, breakfast, lunch out each day to your students?
Yeah, no. It actually, one of the kind of challenges we have on a daily basis is seating in some of our facilities. So we're hoping that this would provide another option to students during those busy times, specifically, you know, during the lunch and the dinner rushes. The other thing that we're really hoping is that, you know, we like to say that we're giving the gift of time, that some of the stories we've heard so far is that students were working in the library on a group project or studying or in their dorm rooms or the residence hall studying, and they didn't want to leave. You know, they didn't want to stop working on their project, so they had their food delivered to them. And that's really kind of what the program's meant for those types of situations, to be able to add, you know, another layer of convenience to students, faculty, and staff on campus that are, you know, students specifically that are juggling more than they have ever juggled in the past.
How much did it cost the university to bring this technology to campus?
Yeah, so there's two common pieces of misinformation that are floating around out there. One is the cost, two is that took jobs away from full-time employees and students, both which are very false. It did not cost the university anything, $0 to bring the robots to campus.
Are you tracking at all which kind of foods are most popularly requested?
Oh, most definitely. We look at that on a regular basis. So far, it's been deli sandwiches have been number one, and number two, very closely followed by pizza and chicken wings.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Peter Testori is Director of Dining and Culinary Services at UW-Madison, and he's managing 30 autonomous delivery service robots on campus. Coming up, we talk with UW-Eau Claire's chancellor about a new task force following racist messages on campus. How do you want universities to address racism on college campuses? Where do you draw the line on free speech versus hate speech? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Chancellor James Schmidt right after a news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a heads up on programming plans this morning at 8. The full House of Representatives begins debate on the question of whether to impeach President Trump. Debate will be followed by a full House vote, and we will bring you live NPR coverage of that full House debate and vote on impeachment. That's coming up in about 25 minutes here on WPR and online at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about the campus climate at UW-Eau Claire. Five members of its football team were suspended from the team after being accused of using the social media platform Snapchat to convey racist messages that appeared to target a campus black empowerment organization. So it's been nearly 1 month to the day since these posts were made public, and we're looking at UW-Eau Claire's response. What questions do you have about how a university addresses racism? Are you a UW-Eau Claire student or faculty member? What are your thoughts on what's transpired? We're at 800-642-1234. James Schmidt is Chancellor of UW-Eau Claire, and he recently announced the formation of the Rapid Action Task Force for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. Chancellor Schmidt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
So the UW Leader Telegram reported over the weekend that an investigation into these racist Snapchat messages is complete. What can you tell us about conclusions from this investigation?
Well, of course, I can't comment specifically on how that investigation concluded and what the consequences were. Those actions are protected by federal privacy rules for campuses known as FERPA. I did consult with UW System Council in an attempt to try to be as transparent as we can with that process. And all I'm really allowed to say is, in fact, we are aware of the incidences, we've investigated them, the investigation has completed, and that sanctions, as appropriate, have been levied with students who've been involved with that.
Would this type of action, this type of incident, would you see that, you can't talk specifically understand, but do you consider this actions grounds for expulsion?
So that would speculate, again, on those instances, on the specific incident. Generally, there's a continuum of sanctions that can be levied against students for breaking what we refer to as the Blue Gold Code or the Student Conduct Code at the institution. We're allowed to look at a range of possible consequences, but there's a lot of legal precedent for what kind of steps you can take and how far you can go with specific incidences.
Well, take us back to those messages. What can you tell us about what was conveyed on Snapchat and what was offensive about them?
Well, and again, offensive isn't the only standard, but let me describe the situation as I understand it. There was a small Snapchat group, which is typically made up of individual classes of football teams, since the football team is so large. Typically, as they come in their first year, they identify just a group to stay in communication, indicate when weightlifting is going on, changes in practice schedules, just ways to communicate quickly to members of the team. That is not a university Snapchat group. We have no oversight of it. There are no coaches or administrators on that particular site. that has changed. I'll come back to that in a minute. But even as football players leave the team, they still remain on that because it's not being actively managed. At one point, there was a member of the team that was simply announcing to members of that group that there was a Black Male Empowerment Group meeting on a specific day at 7 o'clock. And again, it's often used to communicate things that might not be specifically about football. And there was an unfortunate series of responses to that. And it referred to something, you know, a white male empowerment group was in, meant. And I'm sure the students thought that was funny, and that was followed up with racist images of burning cross and a Klan's meeting, and then a series of other comments that were pretty aggressive. And I'd rather not give them too much more energy than that. Although one of the differences and one of the things that makes this case a little more focused is the comments were violent in nature, suggested that people they don't agree with would be burned. And since it was focused towards the Black Male Empowerment Group, that was one of the lines that we needed to examine when reviewing the case. You know, people have freedom of speech, but threatening comments towards individual people or small groups of people is a different matter. So this private Snapchat conversation was then screenshotted and then shared more broadly on social media. And that's when it came to the attention of the coach and the athletic director, and when I was called immediately when that appeared.
So what has changed about the forum of this Snapchat group and how it is regulated?
So I immediately, it's one of those things, I immediately asked the athletic director to direct all of the coaches and teams to eliminate all of those social media chat groups unless they're also included with coaches or athletic administration to be in the loop and monitored. If we're going to have those as a way to officially notify players of specific team issues such as practice, weightlifting schedules, et cetera, then it needs to have oversight by the university. It does not prevent people from having their own friends and subgroups, but it should not be set up as an expectation of how we're going to communicate if it doesn't also include university coaches.
How have students felt about that change?
I've heard no pushback whatsoever about that. This is simply about being appropriate. We expect, you know, all of our faculty, all of our coaches and others are in with groups of students. A big part of our role is educational. And so if you have coaches who are involved in the loop and someone makes even just an off-color comment, that's an opportunity for education. It certainly probably wouldn't be to the extent that we saw with the burning cross, which really crosses a lot of lines. But even if people are making off-color comments, that's an opportunity for education. You don't have to embarrass people. That's not the way we do it. But coaches can take students aside and say, that's inappropriate. Here's why that might be misconstrued. I've had to have those conversations with my own kids when they've picked on each other, you know, brothers pick on each other, and I say, it's not funny. Because a lot of times that's the defense. Oh, they're just being funny. It's not funny. It has an impact on people. And I think most people don't want to intentionally harm people through the comments that they make.
We're talking with James Schmidt. He's chancellor of UW-Eau Claire, and he recently announced the formation of the Rapid Action Task Force for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. We'll be talking about in just a moment. Meanwhile, you can join in the conversation. Are you a person of color? How do you deal with racism in your everyday life? What needs to change at your work or at your school? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chancellor, the football players' investigation came shortly after another incident on UW-Eau Claire's campus where a racist note was left on a student's dorm door. Do you know who was responsible there or what the implications are?
We don't know, and it's really frustrating. Frankly, most racist messages that appear on college campuses are anonymous. I'm grateful that for the most part of society, that those kinds of comments and racist acts are not acceptable, and therefore people do it in the dark of the night or when someone's not looking. That's a good indication that something's not okay. And so campuses across the country have had incidences like this. something that's a little different about Eau Claire is we've set a higher standard for ourselves. We've mapped this out as one of our essential guidepost goals is to close the opportunity gap at the university. We're an educational institution, and people need to have the opportunity to succeed in their education. And racism is one of the things that pushes down people, continues to remind people of our past, and continue to suggest you're not worthy of this educational experience. You're not worthy of climbing that ladder of success. That's the reason this institution has taken, frankly, such a passionate response to this. And by working on this for decades, and it's certainly been a focus of my administration in now in my seventh year, that we've brought these issues to light. When they happen, we don't sweep them under the rug. We put a bright spotlight on them because it's an opportunity for a campus conversation. And in the process, you know, people are reminded of it. We bring it out in the light, and so people are hurt by it and affected by it. But these are our opportunities for education, and that's what our focus is here. So the instance that happened, it's still under investigation. We continue to have anonymous opportunities for people to give us tips on that. The police still have it as an open investigation. We're unlikely to identify them. And this has happened in the past, not only here, but other places. What made the instance of the message on Snapchat is that was brought into broad daylight, and we were able to identify students who are engaged in it and doing a proper investigation.
How has your campus climate changed over your past 7 years at UW-Eau Claire?
So we've done a terrific job, actually, in many ways, but we have a very long way to go. One of the things I'm most proud of, and one of the things that institutions often lag at doing, is diversifying the faculty of the institution. Right now, we have just over 10% of our students are students of color. And nationally, if you look at us, school with our profile, you're likely to find about 5 or 6% of the faculty would be people of color. At our institution, we've averaged between 22% and 24% of our faculty over the last several years. That says that our faculty hiring committees and our dean's administration are committed to making sure we have a diverse faculty. Why? Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, it sends an important message to students of color that there are people that look like them that are in positions of authority, of expertise. But more importantly, by having a diverse faculty, you have diversity of ideas. And above all, universities need to be a place to bring together all kinds of different points of view. And that better prepares not only our students of color, but frankly, all the Wisconsin white kids to come to UW-Eau Claire. We've heard loud and clear from our top employers, and I heard this in the first weeks of me taking this position in 2013, that our employers are demanding that. They're asking for not only helping them reach their goals of having a more diverse workforce. They said they expect the white students that we graduate would have a level of cultural competency because our largest employers have very diverse workforces. And if people don't come into that workforce with that level of cultural competency, they become disruptive.
We got to pause right there with Chancellor James Schmidt right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about racial incidents on the UW-Eau Claire campus and what the university is doing going forward. Racist messages and photos came to light in a social media conversation made public on November 19th. It included racist comments toward the campus group Black Male Empowerment, references to the Ku Klux Klan, a picture of a burning cross. 5 student athletes from the football team were suspended from the team. That investigation is complete, but UW-Eau Claire is not releasing the identity of the players or the severity of sanctions, citing FERPA, the Federal Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. So what are your thoughts on the racial incidents? Do you think task force recommendations can change a campus climate for the better? Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And UW-Eau Claire Chancellor James Schmidt stays with us. Chancellor, last week you held a news conference announcing the formation of this Rapid Action Task Force for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. What is this initiative?
Yeah, so, you know, universities are known for having blue ribbon commissions and other things and having many of those activities that don't go anywhere. If you look at my track record, I've done that very seldomly. We developed this notion of a rapid action task force back in 2015 when the UW system had the enormous budget cuts. And something that's very unusual on a university campus is we don't form the task force to meet for years and then come up with a report that sits on a shelf. Rapid action task forces are given between 30 and 45 days to collect the broad group's best thinking of actions in this case that we can do right now. So they have a very clear charge with lots of suggestions that have come in from the campus community of what can be implemented, not just decided, implemented yet this school year. Before all of this had come up, we were in the process of replacing a vice chancellor that oversees equity, diversity, inclusion on our campus. His first day, by the way, was on Monday of this week. And our plan was to open up more of a five-year planning exercise that would happen in the spring after he got his feet on the ground and familiar with the campus. That will still go forward, and that'll be a little bit more typical, longer-range-looking group. But we needed to take some steps right now. There were some very obvious things that we can do to improve the situation, and we wanted to make sure we heard the feedback from our faculty, students, and staff of what we can do yet this school year.
So the timeline you're looking at for this rapid response here is they met, I understand, December 9th, and they'll provide recommendations to you by the end of January?
That's right. And then we kick off our spring semester right after that. So that report will be shared with the campus community. We'll have an opportunity for people to give feedback on it. Some of those actions we'll take to some of our shared governance groups because they can have far-reaching impact on the institutions. And some of the things I'll be able to simply sign off on and implement at the institution.
Your University Senate approved a resolution to notify relevant faculty and staff before the news media of any incident like this and provide guidance on how to handle an incident. Can you explain what this resolution will do going forward?
It's really just meant to develop processes and communications of how we can handle these situations a little bit better. I'm grateful that they don't come up every day. And in this instance, the administration dropped the ball. We thought we'd had lined up to have faculty communicated right away, particularly the faculty that had these students in their classes, first of all, to let them know whether or not they'd be attending. And we dropped the ball on that. And I was at a business leaders meeting the next morning, and a television camera was turned on me where I had the opportunity to explain what had happened. And so I appreciate the effort that the faculty have done to try to help us map that out. And one of the takeaways from this will be how can we make sure that we're doing the proper communication. The co-chairs of the Rapid Action Task Force have told me they'd like to focus on three specific areas to try to keep their focus narrow enough so it's achievable. The first is communication, interestingly enough. The second is accountability. So how does a campus respond? Because we know these incidences will pop up again. And how can we do a better job of creating a culture of expectation around these issues?
We're talking with James Schmidt, Chancellor of UW-Eau Claire. Let's take a call now. Karen joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to commend the Chancellor on this wonderful, so needed program. Speaking from personal history, I'm a white woman born and raised in Green Bay. I married an engineer in the early 70s who was black, and it always amazed me how much racism he was up against. Even though he was raised very middle class, he was very educated, his family was very educated, he had to struggle harder. He had to overcome more things than a typical white person would. And I think that that combined with the insurgent racism we're seeing now that makes it easier for people to do what has just been, what the Chancellor is just describing, it's so important that he made these changes.
Go ahead.
I'm just grateful that he's doing this, and I wish every school in UW system and all over would do this.
Karen, thank you for sharing your story. Chancellor Schmidt, have you been in touch with other chancellors on other UW campuses?
Certainly. And, you know, I've had great support from my colleagues who wanted to learn how we've been handling it and what they can learn from the situation. Certainly, our report will be made very public when the task force completes its work at the end of January. And we'll continue to share. It's on our website. All of these things were very transparent. As I mentioned earlier, one of our top goals, we have four guidepost goals around student success, and one of them is to close the opportunity gap, and we believe that'll increase the number of students of color on our campus as well. We have a public dashboard, so people can see exactly how we're doing closing the gap. What does that mean? How are people of color? What are their graduation rates? What are their retention rates? What's their participation in our high-impact experiences that we're known for, such as undergraduate research study abroad? So we put it all out there and we show it by group. And, you know, some years we've done really good and you can see years where we've slipped a little bit, but it's all there in the bright daylight.
Let's bring in Mark now in La Crosse. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. See, earlier the chancellor had mentioned that there was a threat of violence in the Post. I was reading the article in Journal Sentinel this morning and I didn't see where there was any actual violence threatened, you know, in the Post. And other question I have is with the task force being formed going forward, you know, a number of these incidents across the country have been found to be hoaxes. You know, will the task force be cognizant of the fact that that the event might be a hoax? And the last point I'll make is that universities across the country seem to be losing some lawsuits lately over violating free speech rights. And how will the task force take that into account?
Mark, thank you. And Chancellor Schmidt, a multi-part question there, maybe perhaps starting with what is a hoax, but still those implications.
Well, in the most recent incidents, the postings were tagged by individual students, and I can't comment specifically on that incidences, but this one's a little bit more rare because it was out in the open, and you know, they're actually students we can interview in the investigation to find out whether or not that was true. When it's anonymous, we often can't find out who did it, so I'm not going to speculate on a hoax or not. I believe that most of them are very credible and very, very real in what's happened.
Where does the university draw the line between freedom of speech and hate speech?
Well, you know, the courts have struggled with that for quite some time. In fact, the courts have held many forms of hate speech are actually allowed. This becomes difficult. In the most recent incidences, there was a specific action of burning people who we don't agree with. And that's a very that is a violent act. And I will tell you, the response on this campus, not only from the Black Male Empowerment Group, but faculty, staff, and students, was quite, that stirred up a lot of memories. There are a number of people who've had family who have been negatively affected by the acts of the Klan. And, you know, part of our process and part of things that are considered in a judicial setting on our campus is a restorative justice approach. And a lot of times students don't realize, or people don't realize, the impact of their actions and their words. And the restorative action process allows the students to be in contact with the people that have been negatively affected and give that opportunity for learning.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was Chancellor James Schmidt, Chancellor of UW-Eau Claire. Just ahead, we bring you special coverage from NPR. The House of Representatives takes up the question of whether to impeach President Trump. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.